We now have about 15 minutes for questions and answers. You'll notice there are two different microphones placed in between the tables. If you have a question, if you can please go to the microphone so your question can be recorded and heard by the panelists. You can direct your question to any of the particular panelists or to all of them in general. And if you could state your name.
Oh, yeah. My name is Tom Hilliard. And I'm with SCIA. Dr. Bond, I actually read your report, Medicaid Empire. Very interesting reading. I recommend it to everyone. And you pointed out something that I think everybody here is concerned about, which is that Medicaid's hospital costs are much higher than hospital costs in other states. But what you don't mention in the report is that, according to other studies, our hospital rates for private coverage are also much higher than other states. And that led me to a certain confusion, which is if moving Medicaid to a market basis is going to curb rising Medicaid costs, then shouldn't private costs be lower in the first place? If they're both at roughly the same levels, or if private rates are even higher, then how does that help us? And relatedly, I'm sure you're familiar with Jan Wenberg's recent reports and the Dartmouth Atlas reports that show that that for people in the last 2 years of life, that the differences in costs from one patient to another are not really payer specific. They're about medical culture. Clearly, all those intense inputs into care, you know, the hospital, the specialists, and so forth, are actually making outcomes worse and hurting people's health. So clearly, we can help people and save money, but
can
it's not dependent on.
Can you just clearly state your question?
Yes, but it's not dependent on patients and co-payments and so forth. It's dependent on provider culture. How would you fix that?
Okay, first of all, I didn't write that part of the report. That's my first response. My second response, and I get this a lot, is you know, why would we want to move away from you know, for example, Medicaid system when you look at reimbursements in the private sector and they're higher, and you know, first of all, you have price controls in the Medicaid sector. The second thing I want to emphasize here is the private sector is fouled up too. There really isn't any free market in healthcare in the United States. In the United States, 80% of people who, and most of us get our health care through our employer because of a silly tax rule from 50 years ago, 80% of people in the United States have precisely one choice in their health care. That's not a free market. I'm one of the lucky people. I have two choices. Now, the one that most of us select at the university comes from a man who's on our board of trustees, who's also on the board of that particular health provider. As long as he's on our board, that's how my health care will be determined. So when you, you know, shop at the company store, you get what the company wants, is what it comes down to. So I see your point here, and my answer is there isn't any free enterprise in private health care. What you need to do is you need to allow individuals to buy in the private sector, just like we're advocating in Medicaid, from competing plans. And the ones that are going to have the incentive to develop best practices, I mean, how we treat illnesses across this country, the variation is enormous. The plans that are going to have the best incentive to do that are going to be prepaid HMO-type plans. Now, they didn't work in the 90s for what reason? Because 80% of the population had one HMO that they were shoved in, the doctors were shoved in it, the hospitals were shoved in it, and nobody accepted its legitimacy because they didn't have any choices. And I blame that on the human resource departments. So my response here in terms of this is you don't have free enterprise in the private sector any more than you have with regard to Medicare and Medicaid.
I'd like to add a little bit to this conversation as well. I think with what we are doing in Florida, we are providing that patient choice. If you look at what happened in Broward County, we have over 9 competing plans. You have various provider service networks as well as competing plans. In fact, the plans are competing to such a degree that we have additional services that they are not required to provide that really are above and beyond the sufficiency level that we require. The plans must have a sufficiency to meet the needs of the population they are designated to serve. They're offering additional things. You can get, they're all offering, or several of them are offering, adult dental care, which is not a normal Medicaid benefit anyway. We have various ones offering for well baby care and for pregnant moms, strollers. You can actually, several of the plans, if you sign up with them and you are pregnant and you do what you're supposed to do, you get a free stroller when you deliver. So if you incentivize competition, I think you will change the dynamics of the system.
Any other questions?
My name is Mark Levitt. I'm an attorney, general practice attorney in New York. I concentrate in elder law, and I'm a member of the elder law section of the state bar. And my question is for Mr. Moses. I'm in favor of long-term care insurance. I'd have it myself, except that when I applied for it, I couldn't get it because I needed a corneal transplant, and so I'm otherwise healthy but couldn't get it. You said that getting the dollars up front is really the way to go, and I agree. And so that I'm confused why you're criticizing the compact that the elder law bar has been promoting for more than 2 years before the DRA was passed as a way to kind of have the individuals pay a chunk of money, pretty well 3 years worth of care, which is more than the average time that people live in a nursing home, and then have Medicaid come in and cover them after they've paid that. I'm confused why you don't think that's a good policy thing, especially since it would actually support long-term care insurance because people could buy long-term care insurance to kind of support that plan. I mean, you've said several other things I disagree with, but which I think are confusing and misinformation, such as.
Can we start with the first question?
Okay, we'll leave it at that. Thanks. Why do you think it's not a good idea?
First of all, regarding the long-term care insurance not being available, you can't buy fire insurance when your house is in flames, and you can't buy long-term care insurance in the private market if you already need long-term care or if you are likely to need it soon. That's the way private insurance markets work. Now, with regard to the compact, I wrote in April of 2005 an article congratulating the elder law bar for coming off of its stance here in New York, advocating more long-term care through Medicare. That was the plan, to put it all under Medicare, which is a little like adding deck chairs to the Titanic after the incident with the iceberg. But that was the plan. Now, with this plan, the compact says you will have $300,000 of obligation or half of your assets, and then you can go on Medicaid. Well, I have a number of questions about that. Why would somebody want to participate in the compact when you can already under Medicaid get long-term care paid for? It's very simple. It's only the wealthiest people in New York that even bump into an income or asset problem. So if it's voluntary, I don't think it's going to happen that people would get involved.
The elder law bar disagrees, obviously, with that statement. But go
ahead. That's why I call it the Medicaid Planners Reemployment Act. What you have to do is not find ways to salvage Medicaid as middle class insurance. You have to return Medicaid to a safety net for people truly in need. When it is that, and when wealth is at risk, as it is not now, people will buy insurance, people will use their home equity through reverse mortgages, and you can fix the problem. What you're looking at here is a slight, if that, amelioration of a hemorrhaging program. I could go on, but give others a chance.
Another question, sir?
Yes, Larry Feldman. I'm from the private insurance sector of the industry. This is a very refreshing meeting. To Mr. Moses and talk about the compact. The compact is fool's gold, in my opinion, and the biggest deterrent to people purchasing long-term care insurance is denial, and the compact just feeds into people's denial. In New York State, we have some wonderful initiatives that are taking place, the New York State Partnership and the 20% tax credit. So there are means for people to come in and purchase if the regulators would get together and clamp down on the things that this whole meeting has been about. I'm sorry I didn't have a question. But
wouldn't be the first time. Response?
Let me just say that my mother-in-law has a reverse mortgage. The overhead currently, because it's not a large market, is fairly substantial, but getting it's pretty darn easy. And she's 79 and has had a very rough life. And while she hasn't needed any of these things yet, she did just buy her first new car with that.
All right.
Ma'am?
I'm Kelly Hunt from the New York State Health Foundation. I'm standing up because I'm actually freezing. I'm right underneath a vent. But I do have a question. I haven't heard much about innovation in terms of getting people enrolled in Medicaid, and I wanted to hear your thoughts on what are some of the states doing or what have you heard about getting people enrolled and keeping them enrolled?
I think one of the most important things we're doing as part of our reform is the choice counseling. And anyone who is identified as needing or meeting the requirements for Medicaid, either through the children as the SCHIP program goes out and interviews and looks at eligibility criteria, and they get shifted down to Medicaid, the choice counseling is, to me, the best system. They actually have either individual or group counseling sessions, which helps them determine what plan will meet their needs the best. And you have various websites you can go through. You can actually compare the different plans and see which providers are on the plans. So and what neighborhoods they have either clinics or facilities in, where the hospitals are located. So by the entire choice counseling package, I think you're making it much easier for patients who are on Medicaid to get the services that they need.
We have time for one more question. Can you use the microphone, please? Because we're recording.
Richard Propp. How did you get the plans to sign up to service your Medicaid patients in terms of their fee structure versus fee-for-service Medicaid?
We already had a percentage of our patients enrolled in Medicaid in the past. We statutorily have gone through a process where we've been putting more patients into Medicaid as a cost containment measure. However, we had no encounter data to prove that they were getting appropriate care. So that was one of the things we also wanted to put in here was to gather encounter data so we would know that patients are meeting those sufficiency requirements the plans were. We actually went out, and that outreach effort was so much a part of it. And bringing the plans into the entire reform was essential. As we went out and started this process 2 years ago, we went to various communities and talked to patients and talked to providers. We then also went and talked to plans and said, we're going to do this. We are determined to do this, and you have to have the political will to be determined to do it. At that point, then you have plans stepping up to the plate and saying, you know, we can do this if you give us the ability to, if you pay us on a risk basis. In other words, if we take someone who's diabetic, hypertensive, and has mental illness, three very expensive morbidities, we can, and you pay us by the risk we take, then the plans are willing to step up to the plate. If you're just going to pay them on the same basis, a flat per member per month, $100 per member per month, and all comers, then they're very reluctant to do it. So you have to really make sure that you have that conversation up front with the plans, that you do risk-adjusted payments. And we're starting out with our risk adjustment based on historical evidence that we have from pharmacy data. That's not 100% accurate. It gives you a base to start with. We're going to move to really a chronic illness model and over the next 3 years. And we're looking for input from the plans and how we adjust that and how we develop that. And I think every player has to come to the plate. But you have to first have the political will to say, we are going to do this.
Also related to that, Florida has a what's called a catastrophic component, which is just the reinsurance that I talked about. And that's critical in terms of getting competition in rural areas. That's one of the reasons TennCare flopped, was there was no effective competition with regard to that. None of this works without real competition. That's how markets work. The other thing that goes on there is even in urban areas, suppose you have a small group of physicians who say, we want to get in and serve this population, but we can't possibly see a critical mass to get some predictability in our expenses here. The reinsurance allows innovative medical providers to develop prepaid practices and get in and start tackling these problems. Florida actually has a reverse cherry-picking aspect to it. You are allowed to design a plan specifically to deal with HIV, with problem children. It's exactly the opposite of what you sometimes run into in health insurance when you don't get risk adjustment. So,
also want to comment a little further on the catastrophic component. I went through this very quickly when we were talking about defined the different financial options, the finance methodology. In our rural communities, we will allow a plan to just offer or to take risk for a comprehensive package. When the patient reaches the expenditure over a certain number and that number is negotiated with the agency and within the contract, then they fall into the catastrophic element and the state bears that responsibility. So we were able to get the competition in those rural areas where you have several plans going out and willing to compete because they are not at full risk. There's that catastrophic cap that the state will reinsure.
Thank you very much. Please join me in giving a round of to our panelists. We are now going to have a very brief break while we set up for the next panel.